It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are directly tied to human activity, and the impacts of these emissions are being experienced all over the globe. These are among the findings from the most recent report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Counties and cities across the nation are trying to navigate competing interests to address the growing threat of climate change. But in rural communities, particularly in southwestern Pennsylvania, whole towns are built around coal production or fossil fuels, and there aren't deep wells of money to address emissions. Veronica Koptis is the executive director of the Center for Coalfield Justice, an organization advocating for policy and regulations for fossil fuel extraction. The organization is based in Washington County. Veronica, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi.
Veronica, when we see this big climate study and the subsequent media reports, how are or are rural communities involved in the conversation?
I think with the rural communities that we work with in Washington and Greene County, it's much more granular in the immediate impacts that we're facing from fossil fuel extraction as it's happening in our communities. And I myself have grown up in Western Greene County, which economy is very much has been historically dominated by the coal industry, and facing economic strain as the decline in the extractive industries continues to happen. And so when we hear a report like this, the initial question is not surprising that there is real consequences to extracting these resources and burning them. But what is our government and our political leaders going to do to make sure the resources are there to clean up the mess left behind, be more climate resilient, and transition our economies to be diversified and sustainable?
Veronica, you mentioned growing up in Greene County. What are some of the everyday impacts from climate change that you feel you've experienced living in that county?
The impact of fossil fuel extraction that we see on a daily basis is not being able to trust our water quality that we're drinking. With the expansions of longwall coal mines, the struck people's homes, their properties are destroyed, the structures are impacted.
Are you concerned the community, the county, doesn't have the infrastructure to protect you and your family?
I mean, living here, yeah, I think those are concerns that there is not a lot of protection. But on the plus side of it, what we do see is community members coming together, local governments trying to advocate for what they need from the state and federal government too. And there is a tide that is changing where residents know there's an economic shift happening. They know that there is increased impacts from the climate crisis that will occur. And we are the only ones that are going to protect us, and history has shown that. We are the only ones that have ever protected us before, and we are working together to ensure those protections going forward.
According to the DEP, Greene County is responsible for about 75% of the coal production in the region. If you decrease or even phase out that production, how will the county, how will the communities have the revenues to invest in improved infrastructure?
Well, there's initiatives already happening that can help invest in our infrastructure. There is the Build Back Better investment plan that has been authorized through the American Rescue Plan that has already passed. And so there's $300 billion of grant money available for communities to start doing economic development and investment. And I think the work that more of that type of investment needs to happen, it is unrealistic to expect these communities to be able to handle the abrupt economic change on their own. But it is the responsibility of the people who are leading our country to invest in our local leaders to drive the change that we need forward.
In Washington County, where your organization, Center for Coalfield Justice, is based, coal production has dropped dramatically over the last 5 years, according to the DEP. However, Washington County has the most fracking wells in the state. Is that a concern or just the coal production?
both fracking and coal extraction and use are concerns for our community members, because at the end of the day, even if we have a thriving economy, if people don't have access to clean drinking water, or their public health is being impacted, or we're stressing about when our kids are going to get cancer because of toxic pollution exposure, no one's going to move here. Like, the economies won't grow if our communities aren't perceived as healthy to attract parents, to attract families to want to raise their families. So I think in the work that we're doing with environment and economic justice is addressing the harms that are happening, getting better protections at the state and federal level, and creating a transition plan. Like, an abrupt shutdown in any one of these industries is not a win to our communities, because you'll just have mass poverty, flight from the communities. And so it's about learning from the past, particularly in southwestern PA when an industry is on the brink of collapse, and creating an economic plan to move out of that. So when these companies can't extract profit off of our resources and labor anymore, we have a plan. And that plan will only work with federal and state investment into our communities. Mm-hmm.
So transitioning away from fossil fuels and the resultant loss in revenues and jobs would likely require federal government investment or state government investment or both. Is there trust that if government sets deadlines for reducing emissions and for transitioning to renewables, that there will be the necessary help to do so?
The work that our organization does here is to ensure that that happens. If we sit down and we don't do anything, do I trust the government will move forward on their own, accountable to poor and working people? No. But working class folks, families in Washington and Greene County are organizing and building together to make those elected leaders work for us and move what is needed and possible.
There's no significant reduction in emissions without the rural community's involvement, not just for coal and fossil fuels, but agriculture. What do you feel are some key focus areas that climate activists should be investing in for rural communities?
You know, growing up in Greene County, raising a family here right now, you know, infrastructure investment is still key. Like, the same thing that you would see in cities that you need to invest in, the assumption is that we also need those in rural communities too. And when you have communities that are built to be sustainable, that are built to be thriving, the jobs will follow, the growth will follow. It always boils down to, is that a place I want to live and raise my family in? And if that isn't, then no one's going to put their business there. Like, those school districts aren't going to get any better. Your tax base is not going to grow. I mean, I would say the same tactics that you use to improve a city is really not that much different from a rural community. The difference is our communities have been neglected in this type of investment in infrastructure for decades. And so we are trying to build back from a long time of a lack of investment in these types of basic services.
Veronica Koptis is the executive director of the Center for Coalfield Justice. Veronica, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Pennsylvania has a new database that allows users to explore and better understand the rate of incarceration and parole across the Department of Corrections. Governor Tom Wolf said this improved information sharing can help create a more fair correction system. But how impactful are improved data visualizations? Clementine Jacoby is the executive director of Recidiviz, a nonprofit that created the state's database. Clementine, how long have you been working on this database for Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so Recidiviz is a technical nonprofit, a group of software engineers and data scientists, and we build data systems like this for state corrections departments across the country. And the first thing we have to do is build the database itself, which brings together sometimes fragmented, siloed data sources from across prisons and parole. Once we've done that and we've gotten the data into a standardized place, then we're able to launch these dashboards like the public dashboard that Pennsylvania just launched. And that itself only takes on the order of 6 to 8 weeks. But building the data platform in the first case can take a little longer, just depending on what the data sources look like.
Who reaches out to who? Did you guys reach out to Pennsylvania and say, hey, we see that you have this kind of database already. You're already offering some of this, but we think we can make it a little nicer looking or something along that line?
So actually, the public dashboard that you're seeing now is a sort of natural next step that builds on the work that we've been doing with Pennsylvania for a couple of years. So the first thing that Recidivist does when we partner with the state is we actually clean up the data to give the practitioners, the decision makers, a real-time picture of what's working in the criminal justice system. And so for the first year and a half of our partnership with Pennsylvania, we were entirely focused on getting information to the decision makers within the system internally. Starting a couple of months ago, Secretary Wetzel and Governor Tom Wolf decided that they wanted to make a more beautiful, more intuitive, and more real-time version of their criminal justice data available to the public.
What does a visualization mean in the context of your work?
Yeah, so criminal justice data suffers from a bunch of different things. One is that it's often really stale. It's reported at a huge lag. So when we find out, you know, how many folks are in jail and what are the characteristics of those people and how long are they staying, those numbers are often reported at a 1 or 2 or 3 year lag. Another was just that often when criminal justice data is presented, it's very counterintuitive to the public. So unless you're an expert working in the field or a practitioner in corrections, it's pretty hard for you to navigate these spreadsheets and numbers that you see online. And what Pennsylvania wanted to do with this dashboard was not just give people the data, but contextualize it. And so part of the goal here is to make the data accessible, but I think maybe an even more important goal is to make the data intuitive and understandable to a much larger audience than would be able to understand it if it were a bunch of numbers in a spreadsheet.
So there's a lot of talk about how this improves transparency, but did you guys get or push for new data, or is it just that you're making the data easier to read?
Yeah, no, this is definitely new data. It's much more comprehensive than what you could have gotten before, although Pennsylvania has always been a very data-forward state. For example, if you go to the website, you'll see that there's an entire page on racial disparities in the system. And if you explore that page, you'll see the pretty significant progress that Governor Wolf's team and Secretary Wetzel's team have made over the last 10 years. There's been about a 13,000 person drop in the prison population, and about 70% of those people have been people of color. The data tells a very different story when you see it sort of in this narrative format and are able to see it over time. But also there's just two new things going on. One is there's a lot more data there than was there before. You can look at this racial disparity data all the way back in time. You can look at the prison and parole data sliced by any number of things that you're interested in. But the other thing that's different is that this data is being refreshed weekly. One of the things that COVID taught us in the criminal justice system is that relying on year-old data is not great. During COVID, it made absolutely zero sense to look at data from a year ago because the economy was completely different and prison populations were down as much as 25% in some places. And so it really created this desire from leaders. That desire already existed, but it really emphasized the need for fresher, real-time data. So I think those are the two key differences.
Do you think that there has been a kind of lack of investment in, you know, user-friendly, public-facing data visualization in government?
Oh, 110%. Like, it's wild that you or I could go to the App Store and spend 99 cents getting a very slick mobile experience, and that the government and institutions that we really care about as a society have to spend $9 million and wait 9 years to get delivered a piece of software that is, you know, sort of a garbage fire on delivery and not what they asked for and incredibly expensive and very difficult to use. One of the reasons that we started Recidivist was to try to combat that, was to try to give agencies good user experiences as a nonprofit that had sort of no financial incentive to make money off of the system. And the thing that surprised me the most coming from the private sector to working in the public sector was that the practitioners themselves, the decision makers making hugely important decisions, everyone from prosecutors and judges to corrections leaders and probation and parole officers, they don't have the data that they need to make good decisions. They want the data and they don't have it, or they have it, but it's not at their fingertips, or maybe it could plausibly be at their fingertips, but it's so unintuitive and it's so burdensome to navigate that they can't plausibly use it in their day-to-day because they're busy. And so all of those problems need to be solved, and all of those problems have been solved in the private sector for a long time. And I find that very frustrating, that like the institutions we care the most about are getting a way worse buying experience, a way worse user experience.
Clementine Jacoby is the executive director of Recidiviz, a nonprofit data visualization organization that works specifically on criminal justice. Clementine, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Allegheny County has been reporting recently nearly 200 new cases of COVID-19 a day. The uptick in cases means more people are masking, pushing for vaccinations, and avoiding public settings. Movie theaters were among the many industries that suffered during the pandemic. There was a glimmer of hope, but a recent survey and less than impressive box office showings could indicate another slump. Carolina Pais-Baeto-Thor is the CEO of the Tull Family Theater, a nonprofit independent theater in Pittsburgh. Carolina, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. My pleasure.
Carolina, when did your theater reopen its doors to customers after shutting down completely?
We reopened last July, right? We closed in March 2020, and we reopened as a couple weeks after the governor allowed us to do so.
At what capacity?
Oh, at that time, I believe we reopened at 25% capacity, and there were some changes, I think, in August and then September. So we went as low as 10% capacity.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what's the capacity for the theater when all things are normal and when you've got the crowds coming in?
We have two screening rooms. One seats 169 people, the other one 69. So if you think about it, the smallest one, the Huntington Bank screening room, 69 people at 10%, we have less than 7 people.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of programming did you offer during the pandemic with the limited crowds and even while you were shut down?
Sure. While we were shut down, we tried to remain connected with our audience, connected with the patrons via online virtual programming. This type of programming did not do so well for us, and frankly, did not do so well for most of the independent theaters around the country that tried similar ventures. But it offered an opportunity for us to keep emailing and remain engaged with the audience. Mm-hmm. Once we reopened, we adapt as quickly as possible to try to provide the same programming that we had before, a combination of new releases, independents, classics. However, due to the upendness that happened in the industry, in the cinematic industry, we were not able to get a lot of the new releases as their release dates were just pushed up.
Mm-hmm. But when you actually had people back in, 10%, 25%, and how high did you build up, by the way?
I think late June, we were at 100%. That's not to say that most of our screenings reached the maximum capacity, but we had gotten to a point where we didn't need to have any limitations anymore.
Are you concerned about the increasing cases of the Delta variant, both, you know, for the whole community, but also for your business, for your organization?
Well, of course, we are monitoring the situation very closely, as we haven't stopped since the beginning of the pandemic. And we are already taking measures to address these changing circumstances. We have limited occupancy back to 50%. Even at 50%, in the largest screening room, for example, it would be 80 people, and we are not reaching those levels of attendance.
What kind of financial situation are you in right now? Because you were closed for a while, you had 10% occupancy for a while, you went up, and now you're back down. So how are you doing financially?
We are very fortunate to have the support of a lot of people with a nonprofit. Every time we sell a ticket, we ask for a donation, and we have a very high number of donors. At the same time, the government support of last year was critical for the theater to remain open. Those federal fundings really are going to ensure that we cross 2021.
So 2021, okay, but what about next year? Are you thinking about that yet? Concerned about it? What?
Yes, we are, right? As a startup nonprofit, we've never been in a situation that we could look 5 years ahead. Having said that, prior to the pandemic, we were just about to cross the line of feeling like a more established organization, and now that has been postponed. So we are very conservative in our projections, and we are trying to adapt to changing circumstances.
Mm-hmm. As a nonprofit, in the movie industry, what did your business, what did your organization learn from the pandemic?
Well, as a nonprofit, we had always been nimble, right? We're very small. We only have 4 full-time employees, believe it or not. But instead of nimbleness being a trait of our organization, it became a necessity, it became critical. So I think that now we're just very much more open to quickly adapt.
Are you optimistic, cautious, what, when it comes to movie theaters in the Pittsburgh area and specifically yours in the next year or two?
Well, we always have to keep optimistic, but at the same time, conservative and smart when we are planning financially.
Carolina Pice Baieto Thor is the CEO of the Tull Family Theater, a nonprofit independent theater in Pittsburgh. Carolina, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcasting app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Sutsui, and Kevin Gavin. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.